You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
It's an honor to be part of this discussion today. I apologize for if there's any audio or internet issues for me. I'm in rural Maine helping take care of my mother-in-law, but not in my normal office in the Hudson Valley. This is an incredibly important discussion. I hope those in the audience will submit questions. You'll see a Q&A box on the screen, and we'll try to get to as many as possible toward the end, and I can follow up, you know, as much as I can in the projects I do online in the coming days and weeks and months. This issue of clarifying what can happen to foster resilience, to foster equity, to reduce potential for conflict, where climate and people are changing, is one of the most important challenges we face. Obviously, as the statistic, that one statistic that Joe just included, I think really spells out where we're going in terms of the changing climate. But what I learned as a journalist, I've been writing about climate change for since 1988, since before there was an IPCC and the UNFCCC, is that the social climate is still the most powerful determinant of bad or good outcomes. The climate is changing. Coastlines will be changing for centuries to come. But how we respond, what we can do in society is a key. Carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are also kind of easy to look at. They're easy to measure. They're not easy to look at. They're easy to measure. Cyclones are events. So what do we pay attention to in the media and in politics? Events, disasters. We don't do a very good job of paying attention to these underlying conditions that don't come with a sudden dramatic violence through the span where you just heard that statistic at the beginning. You know, we're now at a 30-year high of global violent conflict right now. So Gillian Caldwell, she's the climate change coordinator and deputy assistant administrator at the U.S. Agency for International Development, responsible for planning, directing, and supervising all climate and energy work at the agency. That is a huge challenge and opportunity, and we'll talk about that. Her long career at the intersection of human rights and environmental action, particularly her focus on communication, the role of video and film, makes her a very special guest today. Communication matters enormously. What we see is what we pay attention to. What we don't see is what we miss. Ambassador Fred Ngoga, who's the head of Conflict Prevention and Early Warning Division of the Early Warning Division at the Peace and Security Department of the African Union, is here. A long and storied career right in the middle of on-the-ground situations where things go one way or the other, and we have great regrets or lots of congratulations. Patrick Youssef, Regional Director for Africa, the International Committee of the Red Cross. I'm in touch quite a bit with the Red Cross these days, sadly, in the journalism that I do. You know, again, we're in a chronic state of emergency in so many parts of the world. He's worked on the ground in Sudan, Chad, Yemen, Iraq, so many places. We're going to start right away with a set of sort of initiating questions. And I'll start with Polly, and then Gillian, and then Ambassador Ngoga and Patrick. I'm not seeing you on screen, but I'm assuming you're all visible to the audience. Polly, what I try to do when I talk to people in my webcast is start with a very simple question. How did you become who you are so far? That can take a little time, and I think we have a good sense of what drives you and how you got to where you are. But what I really want to get from each of you today is some input on this question. When you think about these words, climate, conflict, and peace, the core questions on the table here today, what keeps you up at night? Like, what's the core one or two things that give you a sense of opportunity or sense of frustration?
Okay. I guess I'll jump right in. Thank you, Andrew. And I just want to thank USIP and AFP and Liz in particular for your energetic leadership on this topic and everybody involved in putting together this amazing event. And it's an honor and privilege to be here. So I think to answer your question, Andy, you know, jumping right in, I'm going to speak from what we see in our work on the ground in Nigeria with our partner, the NEEM Foundation, is that climate change is significantly compounding conflict dynamics. And, you know, as research has demonstrated, it is a threat multiplier, exacerbating existing vulnerabilities. So, you know, the greatest worry is knowing that the climate security risks will continue to intensify, that the fragile regions in particular are going to experience the most severe consequences of climate change and often with the least capacity to cope, and that people affected by conflict are among the most vulnerable to climatic crisis and also often among the most neglected by climate action. So the concern is, you know, if we don't take concrete action to work differently to mitigate these compound conflict climate dynamics, mostly over resource issues, that the consequences in human terms will be catastrophic and much worse than we're already seeing. But on the other hand, to your point, I mean, along with the threat, there is an opportunity. And I think that was highlighted in some of the comments in the introduction as well, to work differently, to work collectively in a more integrated way, recognizing the need not only for effective national policies and international support for those policies and programs, but also the critical importance of taking sort of an integrated and inclusive approach that includes supporting local actors, working with community organizations, develop very context-specific, conflict-sensitive solutions and approaches to mitigate climatic pressures. You know, the evidence is clear that if climate security adaptation and resilience solutions don't include local voice and experience, they certainly increase the risk of inadvertently exacerbating or creating new conflict dynamics. You know, and I mean, certainly the examples of the impact are not hard to find. The migration from climate is well documented, and certainly in Africa, which is particularly susceptible to the negative effects, with many African economies being primarily agricultural. So maybe I can talk more later specifically about, you know, our project there, but I'll stop there.
No, that's a great start and a great case study. Nigeria has so much opportunity. There's for becoming a dominant player in the globe. You know, it's an enormous country. I just want to dig in on one thing that I've studied or reported on there, which is the importance of getting girls through school and the impediments of getting through girls through school as a pathway to stable populations, to more functional, equitable society. And this gets to where the systems here get really complicated, because there's disruption and violence in Nigeria that's impeding full access to education, then is leading to sustained high fertility rates, limited women's power to shape families. Is that a bigger problem or a bigger opportunity? What does that feel like? That keeps me up at night.
You're asking me. I mean, it is also interrelated. I mean, we see this, you know, we're focused very much on the pastoralist population, and the project we're working on is, you know, early warning, early response systems. We're bringing, you know, pastoralists and herders and trying to bring them together. These are normally antagonistic groups. And to the point that you're making, you know, it's actually been shown that education, you know, for the Fulani, who are the traditional herders, offering educational opportunities has had a measurable impact on giving people, and this including girls, to your point, in sort of mitigating conflict. And there's been a very conscious effort of bringing women into these early warning, early response platforms. And there's a lot of, you know, resistance, as you can imagine, culturally to that. But that, you know, slowly that has changed, and women are actually actively, they're being trained as community dialogue facilitators and playing a really active role. And I think, you know, they're all these intertwined, you know, the things all connect one to another. I mean, it's to your point.
Great. Well, we'll circle back to a couple of those things in the solutions section. Gillian Caldwell, what a career you've had so far. For anyone who doesn't know your journey, dig in a little online. And what a portfolio you've taken on. So I imagine there's more than one thing that keeps you up late at night, but maybe we could focus on the opportunities you see that are so far unrealized. But what are the things that drive you as you look at energy, climate, and development at this at the same time? What does that feel like?
Well, first, thanks so much to the U.S. Institute of Peace and Andy, to you for the introduction. Andy and I first met, I think, 15 years ago when I was leading a campaign to pass a law in the U.S. that would put a cap and a price on carbon emissions. And some of you may recall the Waxman-Markey bill, which passed in the House and got stalled in the Senate, much like President Biden's Build Back Better legislation today. And there's so many important climate-related investments in that bill. And of course, that's a key sticking point for Senators Manchin and others that are holding it up. So, you know, things change and they stay the same. And as far as change is concerned, you know, what's keeping me up at night is that it's coming faster and more furious than even the world's most experienced scientists in the IPCC projected. So, you know, there's this concern that climate change is driving transformation in, you know, extremely negative ways more swiftly than human and natural communities can adapt to. And of course, it has, you know, these really compounding impacts in terms of exacerbating climate and, creating instability in the governments and the underlying physical infrastructure required to respond to climate. I think you asked me about opportunities rather than threats. And of course, try to keep my eyes focused on those because it's just too depressing to spend all your time thinking about what's wrong with the world. And the truth is that, you know, there's so many opportunities. If you think about the risk that climate compounds resource scarcity, which can precipitate conflict. You can look at the opportunity, such as the systems we've invested in with NASA and others, the technologies that give us advanced warning regarding drought and other impending natural disasters, so that we can be proactive in preparing for, both for the potential physical impacts, but in promoting the kind of cooperation and collaboration that's necessary to ensure effective sharing of scarce resources. So, I mean, looking at it from a positive perspective, this can move peace building forward in anticipatory ways more swiftly than it would otherwise, if we're proactive enough. And it pays to be proactive. I mean, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, we've got at least $3 trillion in costs ahead of us on mitigation and adaptation, but we're going to have a whole lot more money to spend if we aren't proactive in addressing the underlying infrastructure and the changes in human community and how we're organized to adapt to this. So, and of course, there's the opportunity of transforming our entire energy system and creating a just transition rather than finding ourselves in a world full of geopolitical tensions and fights over resource scarcity. So I just hope we can keep our eyes on the prize here. I think COVID's another analogy. It's not about going back to the way life was. It's about recognizing the world's fundamentally changed forever. It's continuing to change. And if we adapt in intelligent ways that are, you know, frankly, grounded in some love and justice, we'll be much better off than we were to begin with.
You know, I hadn't thought about this till just now as we were speaking, but I've had recent conversations on my webcast through the Columbia Climate School with Deanne Criswell, the FEMA director. For those who don't know, that's the Emergency Management Agency. And even the name of that agency is anachronistic because it's about managing an emergency, meaning the emergency is already happening. And the disasters and conflict community, everyone in this call today, is about mitigation of risk before the worst happens. And they're doing their best there. There's some interesting projects underway at FEMA to try to tip the balance, even in funding within the agency, toward and commit with the Forest Service, for example, which also has a huge billion plus firefighting budget and sort of $100 million mitigation of fire risk budget. And what you all are focusing on is, well, what can we do within our structures to do the same thing? So maybe we'll follow up and I could try to schedule some kind of a brainstorm between the disaster community and the peace building community. Very interesting. One thing I wanted to ask you briefly before we get to Patrick and the ambassador is about some of the real dynamic tension between energy access and climate stability. USAID, State Department generally, you know, you are still trying to develop, let's say, clean cooking, an arena I've worked really hard in several years ago when I was at ProPublica, the capacity for people to cook cleanly on fuels that don't kill, like charcoal. And yet sometimes that can be a fossil fuel, and many countries from Africa at the COP26 talks were starting to worry that cut off to finance by rich countries for fossil fuel development may impede their energy rights, even as we're talking about climate. So does that intersection of climate and energy priorities come as is there a tangle there, or is that more of an opportunity to?
Well, I mean, there is some tension, but I think it's overstated. Of course, as you mentioned, energy poverty is greater on the African continent than anywhere on the world. More people in Africa are functioning without electricity than anywhere else. And of course, you know, electricity is critical to all sorts of health and education and economically related outcomes. So it's really a challenge. Power Africa is the U.S. government's response to that. It was launched under Obama, and it's an interagency initiative housed within USAID, and the focus is on tackling energy poverty. But over time, they've begun to really evolve their metrics of success to include decarbonization, which hopefully will come into a front and center consideration alongside energy poverty. And in many places, I just read a Bloomberg study indicating that in many places it's cheaper these days to go with renewable energy than it is to go with fossil fuels. The U.S. government has just released guidance which prohibits funding of coal, and which allows funding for fossil fuels only in very limited circumstances where there is no other viable alternative, or whether there's significant national security interests at stake. And, you know, places like Ukraine would be one such example when you look at you know, some of the dependency on Russian oil for a country like Germany. But in any case, I don't think it's as big a challenge as some people would like to suggest. And I think if we're creative in looking at how we can leapfrog over fossil fuel infrastructure and invest in decentralized grids, we'll be much better off.
Yeah. And one thing people miss, including the media, is that the Electrify Africa Act passed in the most divided Congress in history under Obama got signed. There are, if you shape priorities around things that really matter, you know, development, electricity, Africa, even our pretty broken system, the United States, can do some remarkable things. So thank you. And now on to the ambassador. Ambassador Fred Ngoga, head of conflict prevention and early warning, African Union. You, again, have been on the ground in so many situations in regions where climate is the source of vulnerability even now. What keeps you up late at night? I have a feeling you're full of solutions, even as you recognize the problems.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, for inviting me and for having me. I thought it was important for me to be here because this is a topic that is on top of our agenda continentally. What keeps me up at night? What keeps me up at night is the droughts, the high temperatures, the displaced people as a result of climate change. I think, you know, we are the least, you know, the African continent is the least in terms of, you know, the greenhouse emission, yet we suffer the most consequences as we speak. So we recognize that this is for us a priority. We have had about 8 sessions of the AU Peace and Security Council, AU Peace and Security Council agenda, 8 sessions focusing squarely on climate change and its impact on our continent. And we are working very closely, for example, to integrate climate change within our early warning system, therefore helping some of our member states also to be able to establish their own early warning systems about climate change, but also our regional economic communities. We have been actually, the AU has decided to appoint a special envoy, which will actually be focusing on climate peace and security, and also establishing a climate peace and security fund. So these are some of the things that we've been working on, but we are constantly dealing with these conflicts. Many don't know, but actually the Darfur conflict was the first conflict actually, which was a result of climate change. It's often forgotten, but we're having many more. For example, today, as I speak with you, the drought in Somalia is causing so many displacements, and the displacements are actually putting pressure on the host communities. And as a result, the communities are fighting. I heard Polly talking about pastoralists and herders conflict. It is everywhere. We see it not only in Nigeria, but we're seeing it in the Central African Republic. We're seeing it in many countries. So these are some of the challenges that we're faced with. We're trying to our level best to address them. But one thing that is for sure, as Gillian said, if we don't come together and work together, it will impact all of us. An unstable Africa will not serve the world well. It will create all sorts of other issues which will affect everybody. So I think that the more we keep this on the agenda, the more we have constructive conversations, the more people are less selfish and really, honestly address the issues, I think we will do well. We have in November this year, COP 97, which is going to be in Egypt, 27, sorry, is it 27? I think I was getting it wrong. Yeah. It's going to be in Egypt. And so they're going to be discussing some of these issues. And I think it will also be a great opportunity to highlight some of the challenges, but also the opportunities, as Gillian and Polly and yourself, Andrew, has mentioned. Thank you.
That's a brilliant intervention. There's so much to do. And this is a good time to get to this question of what does the developed world... I thought I turned off that phone. Sorry. Again, I'm in rural Maine at my mother-in-law's house. It'll stop in a second. What does the developed world owe Africa? It's not just what's under the climate treaty. We can't get into the whole history of colonization and the like, but if the world wants to have more forecasting capacity for weather disruptions, whether from climate change or natural variability, there needs to be more data and more analysis in Africa, meaning, and also more on the ground capacity in Africa. What are universities like Columbia, where I work, and what are governments not doing sufficiently to build Africa's capacity, even just to monitor and analyze and then convey those risks? There's data gaps that are profound still, just simple questions of how many areas are being monitored and the like. What's that feel like, what for the African Union? It's not just about, how much money you're going to get under the details of the climate agreement. What are the capacities that need to be built?
Thank you so much. This is actually, with COVID, one thing that we realized was that the importance of investing in education and research on the continent. Because the entire world was able to produce vaccines, but we were not able to produce vaccines because we were lacking when it comes to research. So this is something that we want to be investing in, and where we will need actually support from the world in general. And I think that the more we invest in research, the more also we'll be able to invest in the infrastructure that can withstand some of these shocks. I think it's critical. I would like to also highlight something else, which is the continent is facing. So some of these challenges are actually also creating a gap in those who govern and those who are being governed. And as a result, and it's causing a lot of instability on our continent. So I think that the world owes us not only to do what is responsible in terms of limiting their gas emission, but I think that they also, we all need to invest in not only in the early warning mechanism, but also in the prevention. And when it happens, we're going to invest on how to respond to these crises working together.
Well, hopefully we can all work on building better systems so that there are great templates. FuseNet, the famine early warning system, demonstrates that we have this potential to bring together expertise, connections to communities, and do better. Patrick Youssef at the Red Cross, if anyone is in a state of constant response and an emergency, it's you. But every once in a while, you must have the ability to step back and say, where do we go from here? So again, late at night or early in the morning, what gets you steamed up as an opportunity or key problem?
Andy, thank you so much, first and foremost, to you, but also to the organizers, to USIP, but also to the Alliance for Peace Building. And I think if we really think about the impact of what one can achieve, it's exactly with these alliances, with having different experts around the table. It's having different voices, those who can oppose and not only, drive the line of what has been chartered by others. I think what keeps me, but also many managers and field operators in with the Red Cross is the following questions. Are we doing the right thing? Are we as humanitarians doing enough? And I guess what keeps me up all the time and not always at night is this, sense of injustice that we felt when we started speaking about vaccines, COVID vaccines on the continent. As a regional director for Africa, I'm faced with, thousands, hundreds of voices coming from the field about this lack of fairness, about the sustainability of the world's promises and the lack of concrete actions when tackling climate issues. And here, if I may just again pitch from what we hear on the ground, through our work as the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, the biggest network of volunteers, of those people exactly living the dual hardship from wars and violence, I think what we see is very clear. People affected by wars and violence are on the front lines of the climate crisis. If we have to get out of such panels, but also worldwide discussions around the duality of armed conflicts and climate, we really need to put that in huge figures, in big, bold characters. Frontline, the people living the duality are on the front line of the climate crisis. And there's a massive disadvantage when it comes to adapting to climate change. And I think the reasons are obvious, which I hear when I was recently in the Sahel or in Somalia, but also in less visible contexts, to be honest, like the Central African Republic or Mozambique, which, as you know, is currently bracing for the next tropical storm while having to deal with 500,000 displaced people in the region of Pemba. And again, the constat, the evaluation is the same. It's the same, by the way, that obstructs the path to peace and prolongs wars. And many have been mentioned by Joe Hewitt in his introductory remarks. Weakened institutions, essential services disruptions, poor economies, lack of social cohesion. And clearly, while there are very few cases where there was direct correlation between a climate or an environmental degradation and an armed conflict, as per the Geneva Conventions, I think climate change is inseparably linked to some of the most pressing security challenges of our time. And Liz Granby had made reference to this too, which I found spot on. And I think the data, to conclude, supports our observations about this double vulnerability. Some 60% of the 25 countries affected, or the most vulnerable, or at least ready to adapt to climate change, are affected by wars. And I can provide you with a long list. So for now, I think the gist of it is the following. Climate action and finance to support this action are particularly weak in places of conflict because of the challenges I mentioned, because of the hesitancy of those who really can make the difference on the ground in implementing long-term plan in such environments. So as you can imagine, there is an amalgam of 100 and thousands of things to worry about, and on top of which comes this life-threatening menace on people's lives, that is climate hazards and climate adaptation, which is lacking, unfortunately, in today's humanitarian landscape. Back to you, Andy.
Thank you. This is really helpful as well. There's some questions that are coming in, but it's this is the key moment for you and the audience to offer your questions and observations in the Q&A box you should see wherever you're watching. There's a couple that have come in, but I wanted to now start more of a conversation here. And a point that came up that resonates throughout what you've all been saying is, in one way or the other, you've all recognized that if you work on basic components of a system, a social system, that boost resilience, boost equity, reduce vulnerability particularly, you have, that creates sort of an insulator effect when there's a shock, whether it's Mozambique's next cyclone or the like. And we kind of know this, the peace building community knows this better than anyone, I think. But is it starting to percolate into our broader national and international funding and prioritization? I'm going to frame this around something that was said in 2017 when the Trump administration was settling in. There was a conference in Europe on security. And I wrote a story about this. And there was a European official, the High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security. She said, she was talking to the Trump administration, you need the European Union because we invest in basic social development in places like sub-Saharan Africa. When you invest in the fight against climate change, you also invest in your own security. In other words, national security, wherever you are, Germany, the United States, is abetted by cutting vulnerabilities in places in the world that can be unstable. And I just want to get a sense if you feel that's really, is that important? And is it happening? Maybe back to Gillian briefly and then around the circle here. Is the world really getting this?
Well, the military establishment sure is. I mean, the Pentagon has been out in front on climate change as a major national security threat. And there have been a number of both public and classified briefings on point. So there's no doubt in their mind, and they're experts on this front, no doubt in mine either. I think we've still been slow to come to the table. And I think national security arguments, one that resonates on either side of the aisle and can be important. I mean, what you were just saying, Andy, and what our colleague from the African Union Commission was talking about, it really relates to capacity and preparedness. And interestingly, we just commissioned a study on what the U.S. government and USAID in particular could do to accelerate development in Africa. And they honed in, after speaking to hundreds of people across the continent, on two things: digital skills acceleration and climate analytics and planning. And we just launched, interestingly, before we had the results of that study, but hopefully we're on point, an initiative with the African Union Commission called KACI, which is a Comprehensive Africa Climate Change Initiative. So the focus here is on strengthening the country level and regional data capability to create an Africa-wide platform to make sense of the mitigation and adaptation challenges Africa is confronting. And if you look at, the funding, which of course has been too slow to come, as the keynote speaker remarked, but will be flowing, hopefully, in the direction it ought to, from developing countries to developing countries. The question is, what's the readiness? What's the preparedness to absorb that? What are the data? What's the arguments for the use of that money? So I think that's an incredibly important initiative to make sure we're investing in the right places and that Africa is well positioned to argue for and absorb the funding it so desperately needs.
Just briefly, there was a question that came in that got to this. Let me see if I have it right here. And this is a question from the audience. I wonder about the trickle-down effects of these programs, Power Africa and certain World Bank distributed funds for certain states in Nigeria have never been heard of. The people are not feeling the impact. I worry a lot about these on the ground realities. How can we address this? Which kind of gets to your point about it's not just money. It's like, how do you make sure it gets to where it's needed and all that?
Maybe I'll just jump in, Paula, here, you know, on Nigeria, because I think it is just such, it's where we're working, but it is such a, you know, stark case in point about, you know, the impact of climate change, because it's on so many multiple dimensions. You know, it is the most populous country with 200 people, economy closely tied to gas and oil, directly linked to social inequity and awful environmental disasters, and one of the highest rates of energy poverty as well. But it is unquestionably a top national security and recognized as such issue for Nigeria. And it's, you know, it's not just the North again, it's all across the country. And, you know, people being pushed, it just, you know, it's the cascade of effects, people pushed into cities, urban areas, not having capacity and adequate infrastructure, and the erosion of social, you know, societal customs and family structures. And I think, you know, it's, you know, and certainly again, in the pastoralist area, the ramifications, you know, are very direct in terms of national security, because it's well documented that, you know, this farmer herder conflict has sort of increased vulnerability to recruitment by extremist groups, including Boko Haram. So, you know, I think it's kind of in the forefront. And I know the Nigerian government, I think, has passed some, I think like 10 or 11 pieces of, you know, of national legislation related to climate. Some of them, you know, I think have been some missteps and had some, you know, negative repercussions, but, you know, it's no question that it's a huge issue. And I think back to the, you know, Ambassador Ngoga's excellent points and Patrick's, you know, on the capacity of figuring out, you know, where the gaps are, how do things trickle down to the local level? Because it really has to be at a, you know, assistance, and it's a systemic issue, and it has to be approached from a systemic, perspective, i.e. from, you know, all different angles. So, you know, that's just my two cents there.
No, would the ambassador want to offer any ideas on that, these questions? Again, it's kind of like, how do you work on the chickens and the eggs all at the same time?
If I can come in, I think the other time we committed with UNEP to look at, what are the natural resources in dispute, just to kind of get a sense of what we were faced with. And it was interesting. The first natural resource that is a cause of conflict was land. Second was actually minerals. Third was oil. Fourth was water. And the fifth was fisheries. And all these five natural resources, when you look at them, they are all affected by climate change. So, like I said, and as Holly just mentioned, we need to invest not only in early warning. We need to invest in the prevention. How to prevent crisis escalating. We need to invest in the response when the crisis do occur, and most importantly, how do we stabilize the communities that have been affected by some of these changes? And this is something that we tend to often overlook. And I think that I was just thinking of a while back, we saw. We're seeing some countries actually where the water levels are rising. In my own country, Burundi, the other time, the water levels of Lake Tanganyika just rose, and a whole section of the city, people had to be evacuated. So these are some of the things that really, you started earlier, what keeps up at night. You know, we think about all these things, and we look at the resources that we have, our ability to analyze and to respond, and it gives you a headache. It gives you anxiety about how we're going to be able to deal with all of this. Thank you.
You know, and there's a question that came in that gets at your point about Burundi and that lake. It's the challenge of turning global data projections into local, meaningful forecasts and like, is there an information gap in how climate change will impact localized conflict? So conflict, as you said, is related to resources, clashes of cultures, stresses. And I guess this gets to one or the other. To me, it comes down to some of the basics, fostering access to education, making sure that American universities have partner universities in developing countries, making sure that extension services are a real thing, using data. There are some really cool examples of using communication technology, SMS and radio, old-fashioned, to make sure regional, rural areas that don't have the internet necessarily have information. But again, where's the headline in that? if you're a funding a funder, if you're at the UNDP, or how do you do that? It's an interesting question. So I think, Gillian, you had a, Patrick, please.
I mean, it's so difficult to answer this question, although in a way, what should reassure us is that we don't need to start from zero. In a way, we've been also adapting the in the humanitarian sector, our work to really focus on building social cohesion in the communities where such a feature has been either dismantled or totally erased, which explains why, as the ambassador has just mentioned, intercommunal violence, which doesn't amount to a war or an armed conflict, is on the rise everywhere in sub-Saharan Africa, by the way, leading to more death and injuries more than the war with a group like the Islamic State in the Western Africa province around the Lake Chad, or with Jnim and many opposing factions in the Sahel region. So in a way, I think building resilience is part of focusing or zooming in on what matters for people affected by wars and putting people at the center. I think it's very critical to build on what we have already done. If I'm just giving an anecdotal example of a delegation today, if one of our embassies delegations in the field that has built its operational planning for the year to come purely on substitution, and substitution meaning providing food, water, basically making sure that they fill the gap of what governments and institutions should have been doing on their collective behalf, either because they're not present on the ground, governments that is, or simply don't have the control to do it. So I think there we have a lot of features to build on, and I think it's critical to rebalance humanitarian efforts and focus more on preventive responses to strengthen people's resilience and adaptive capacities. And in a way, you know, short-termism is deadly in this role. So to short-term fixes are clearly not sufficient. And I think beyond, because we're all super brilliant in providing the problem analysis. But if we link it to humanitarian consequences and we consider that bullets alone are not drivers of environmental degradations in theaters of war, I think this convergence mostly threatens people's lives and health and worsens food and economic and water insecurity. And in fragile countries which are in danger, they're becoming stuck in these cycles of conflict. I beg anyone on this panel, but also in the audience, to tell me how can we resolve the situation of 7.1 million today in Somalia when we have no access to them, and they're all hit hard by the worst drought in the last decade. So I think conflicts themselves can certainly damage the natural environment, but also reduce further people's resilience. So moving from an emergency, purely emergency mindset to building resilience and focusing on empowering those economic communities that His Excellency the Ambassador mentioned, the fishermen, the agriculture, the farmers, but also the herders, would also not only build their own resilience, but allow for better protection spaces for people that are affected by those transhumans, traveling, stepping into farmers' areas and creating these difficult relations that unfortunately is so difficult to gain. And on the practical side, I want just to propose what we have done in the ICRC, in the Red Cross movement. We've been really working to galvanize, to first to look at ourselves, right? And try with the climate charter, climate and environmental charter for humanitarian organizations to lead by example. This charter has now been signed by over 200 humanitarian organizations, but also gaining more support from states like Switzerland, United States, and Norway. We just launched Climate Fund, which will help us as an organization minimize our emissions by 140,000, but also cut on our expenses from 30 to 50 million Swiss francs in the next couple of years. So thinking about ourselves, but also collaborating with other partners, in my opinion, would be one of the winning recipes, so we don't reinvent the wheel for something that we have, you know, lived throughout our ICRC, but also humanitarian careers. And all of those connected to this call are certainly examples and testimonies of that hard work that has occupied us. Thank you.
Wonderful. It's like a burst of, like a heavy downpour of really great questions has just come in, and we only have about 12 minutes left. So I want to be sure that those in the audience know what I will do. I commit personally to running at least one of my Sustain What webcasts to sort of fill in the gaps as we go forward to do another follow-up. These conversations are never the end of something. They're always the beginning of something. I'm going to try to bundle these a little bit, if that's okay. And then have you all weigh in, just raise your hand or shout out. Cities, of course, whether you're in Africa, in South Asia, are a key part of the future. And I wrote a 2007 story in the Times that showed how cities can greatly insulate or reduce climate vulnerability. It's too complicated to get into the details. But what should be done at the global level to prepare cities in vulnerable regions and or make them more able to do what someone here said earlier, to be a receiving city? This is a term of art these days, receiving cities. Anyone want to jump in there right away? If not, we'll go into the next one. There's this very particular question about for the AU and for the ambassador, I think. How can the AU or other African organizations promote cooperation over complex geopolitical issues like GERD? This is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. What do we need to do with data, resources, or capacities to in situations like this? And if you're not dug in on that, don't worry about it. We can go on. Maybe you might be frozen.
Not sure I heard the question very well. Well, I think my connection was a bit problematic. Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, your connection is a little slow, and that's another issue we can talk about in the future webcast on digital connectivity. How can the African Union or other organizations promote cooperation over complex geopolitical issues like the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam? And maybe we'll circle back to that if time allows. Here's a sort of an overarching question. It actually gets to one that was asked of Patrick. So these two together. One, someone said, what's an example of how you build social cohesion? And there's another question, although conflict is related to resources, isn't separation consciousness or the lack of recognition of the interdependence of everyone's well-being an issue too? In other words, so basically social cohesion. What does that look like? Or are there great examples of how it can be built in situations where things would go badly otherwise?
Maybe I can.
Yeah.
Patrick, do you want to go?
No, please, Polly. Okay. I'll follow.
Quickly. I think, and you know, going back to Patrick's point too about, you know, we're not starting from zero. You know, there are a lot of, you know, things, processes that have been used over time. And I, you know, just point to these early warning, early response systems where, you know, in the instances in our project in Nigeria are bringing people together who may not normally interact in communities. And sometimes they're in fact antagonistic. And it's a process of, you know, people getting to know each other, developing trust. You know, they may not agree, but, you know, having platforms or form neutral forums where people can come together and discuss things, you know, actually does build social cohesion. I mean, you know, we've seen in post-genocide situations, post-Rwanda, post-Bosnia, you know, what is possible and also how challenging it is. But, you know, I think there are, you know, there are very good examples of approaches and tools that have been used over many years where, you know, relatively simple, but it is a, you know, a challenge of bringing people together and developing relationships and means of communication, which are not otherwise possible. And I will hand it over to Patrick.
Yeah. Thanks, Polly. And again, excellent question. You know, it's Polly just spoke about diversifying also our partners, thinking about complementarity, about multi-stakeholders, about multi-sectoral engagement. But, you know, if you think about those spaces that are tainted by wars and violence since years, since now 3 decades in Somalia, 10 years in the Sahel, over 15 years in the Lake Chad region, one has to stop and reflect about and see exactly that in protracted crises, we do have quite a difficult challenge to adapt to the responses we offer to people. Hence the question of bringing some social cohesion back to the communities mostly affected. And I believe, and that's, I'm just inspired by what we do as ICRC, I think it goes through 4 main areas. One is to be able to provide humanitarian responses that brings people's dignities back to the fore rather than create dependence on humanitarian assistance. And here again, we are so privileged to be working with Red Cross and Red Crescent volunteers across the globe. That just provides us that essence of whether people's dignity have been indeed restored by providing them with the food, with the water, etc. The challenges we see today, for example, as in Ethiopia and the Tigray region, 3 years of bad harvest will certainly amount to a crisis, even if it's not a catastrophe already. And I think that's the first element. The second element is clearly building resilience, as opposed to providing 100 kilos of rice for a family that has been displaced for 10 years, to listen to them and architect together the humanitarian response that gives them the opportunity again to sustain their livelihoods and redress by themselves. The third, I think, and that relates to the common elements that international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention say about the rights of people to live in such spaces and brings environmental degradation to the fore. And I think this is a very important point because this does not de-responsabilize states that are enduring armed conflicts from these responsibilities. One of the ministers told me, without naming the state, that what do you expect Patrick to do? All is going to the war efforts, and this is God's will on us. But I, again, comparing to other contexts, that argument doesn't fly that high. So building resilience is certainly third, and fourth is the protection of people from these vulnerabilities, those in places of detention that no one's talk about, those in IDP camps, those migrants stranded in Agadez, Niger, before heading to the Mediterranean. And fourth, I think, is to focus on the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable, meaning those widows, women-headed households, children, migrants, indeed, who live these double vulnerabilities in a totally different way, who don't have livelihoods, who have left their homes because of a reason. But again, I'm saying that it's easier said than done, hence the complementarity, the need to have states also driving, but also regional organizations to drive these changes. And us humanitarians will only be contributors to local efforts rather than driving these responses, which in a way, and I worked in Iraq for 5-6 years, these are not sustainable. We need the local buy-in, and then we can push and debate and negotiate on their behalf. But I loved what I heard last time at COP26. We need African voices, for example, for Africa, that would only be the only recipe for rescue, because the realities are there and they know how to live these realities. And that brings me back to this notion of injustice that I mentioned at the beginning, which should hurt us all. And therefore, I think that's the way forward that I can see in front of us. Back to you, Andy.
Can I jump in on that, Andy?
Yeah.
Are we going to take another?
Absolutely.
So we're
close to the end. Yes, go for it.
I'm just reflecting on a lot of what Patrick was saying and, you know, thinking, of all the experiences we've had in recent history, or are having, COVID and climate are two that I think arguably have touched every single human on planet Earth in one way or another. So on some level, it's a deeply common and challenging experience we're sharing. On another level, as Patrick alluded to, you know, both of these challenges have deepened already existing inequities. So we're not having the same experience of these crises. We're having very different experiences, whether we have access to the vaccine or can live safely or are on high enough ground and so forth. And that's why I think as we as we think about building community and about our response, we really have to be so grounded in equity as a central principle and ensuring that we empower and enable people who are the most marginalized and discriminated against to not just survive, but to thrive and to lead when it comes to action. And it's just the poorest and most marginalized people that are getting hit first and worst here once again.
And can I just jump in quickly? I mean, just to take the point of COVID, I mean, following Patrick, I mean, it's instructive. I mean, absolutely, all these similarities. But I think the experience of what we've all gone through with COVID, I mean, it not only highlights all these challenges that are very similar, but it also, you know, it's instructive. And the climate rich is another systemic risk and challenge, right? That it calls for all the same things, extensive cooperation across sectors, et cetera, partnerships, cooperation, et cetera, and having local voices and equity. I mean, I think it's a very instructive in terms of the challenges and what needs to happen in terms of this issue we're talking about here.
Well, we're pretty much at the end of the allotted time, which for me, again, means this is not even chapter one. This is the introduction to some conversations that we really should drive forward. I'm committed to helping do that with you as guests or others who can come in on my Sustain What broadcasts and what I write. The one thing that I'd like to end these sessions on is a call to all of us to think about what can we do or our institutions do together that we just simply can't do as well individually. You know, what are the key gaps here? Who's not in conversation? Who can reach out to those most vulnerable? Who's working with them face-to-face in a way that can then connect with resources and create actionable pathways? So we'll revisit those questions. Normally, we would talk about them here more. So thank you all for being part of this discussion of this critical juncture between climate change, climate vulnerability, and societal change. What can we do, the social climate, to help us navigate the changing geophysical climate? It's kind of what I've devoted 33 of my 65 years to, and we'll keep going on, and I know you all will be too. Thank you for being here today. I'm sure the audience shares my appreciation and the organizers. I've been asked to give a few housekeeping updates for the remainder of the day. Those registered for the full conference will continue through today on AFP's conference website with a jam-packed agenda of interactive workshops and panel conversations exploring how we can all come together and rise to build peace amid climate change, the COVID-19 pandemic, and a high and global violent conflict. And headlines every day saying there's more nigh if we don't get to work harder. For those of you not registered for the full conference, it's not too late to register! Exclamation point. Seriously. Just head over to the events.bizaboo.com/peacecon@ peacecon at 10 website. Bizaboo is bizzabo.com. events.bizaboo.com. peacecon at 10. Again, all are welcome back later today for the closing of day one, a fireside chat at 4 featuring Robert Jenkins, USAID Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Conflict Prevention and Stabilization. And do something every day to connect with somebody that relates to either a local vulnerability in your own neighborhood or vulnerability across the world, and keep at it. This is a long journey, but it's a hopeful one. And thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.